Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. And what's green or black or brown, slimy or fuzzy, and maybe going underreported since Sandy? Mold. What often shows up after FEMA tells you what home repairs they'll pay for? Mold. What kind of storm damage is often not covered in your private insurance policy? With me now, Michael Riley, environmental health professor at the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. Dr. Riley, thanks very much for doing this. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi. Good morning, Brian. Happy to be here.
First, let me play a clip of the New York City Health Commissioner, Dr. Thomas Farley, on this show on February 2nd. I asked him if they've seen a rise in mold-related illness reports.
No, we're not seeing an increase in asthma, which would be the most common problem that you would expect from that. We're not seeing increases in that would be make us concerned that the mold is really causing an increase.
Now, I assume that Dr. Farley, who's genuinely concerned about public health, was not making that up. And the Times reported similar official no increase statistics for New Jersey as well as New York City. But it seems unlikely to impossible to me that that could be the case. Has your center been compiling stats independently?
We have not been compiling direct data, but we have been interested in this and been looking at it throughout New York, New Jersey, and Long Island. And it's generally something that is true. I mean, we definitely there have been no increase in the reports. And I think that this is definitely something that's been consistent from Irene and Katrina and when we look back at other hurricanes, too. And I think the reason is a lot of the symptoms and a lot of the conditions that this causes, the mild respiratory irritation, is something that goes underreported because people don't necessarily, with a cough or a sneeze or some sort of asthma irritation, necessarily go to their doctors, and therefore it's not reported to health officials, so it's underreported generally. So it doesn't mean that it's not a problem. It could definitely be a problem, but it just means that the numbers at the health departments aren't dialing up.
Right. Well, full disclosure, I once had a mold problem in a past home that I'm sure made members of my family very sick, so I'm prone to believe that mold is dangerous and might be underreported. But the Times article over the weekend had this anecdote. For example, it said Dr. Hilton Lightman, a pediatric asthma and allergy specialist who sees about 100 patients a day at his total family care practice in Far Rockaway, said since the storm, cases of hacking coughs and wheezing have increased so much that he began conducting a survey to see if those patients had flooded homes. The correlation, he said, was nearly exact. So, assuming Dr. Lightman in the Rockaways is seeing what he thinks he's seeing, can you think of reporting reasons or statistical reasons why the city health department wouldn't be seeing this breakout?
Well, you can't see what you're not detecting for. And I think that it becomes insurmountable to do a mold assessment, a quantitative mold assessment, you know, actually taking a sample and sending it to a lab for analysis. It becomes prohibitive to do that in absolutely every place, since it's the guidelines from the CDC and the EPA and other federal agencies are basically that you don't need to have a laboratory test in order to determine that mold is present. A visual inspection is usually good enough. I mean, so if I see that I have mold, or like you'd mentioned, if you have it in your home and you smell it, you know that it's there, you don't need a laboratory test
right.
to confirm that.
But I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about why aren't they seeing these clusters of symptoms in areas that were tremendously affected by Sandy, like that doctor in the Rockaways is reporting for his own practice? Why don't they see this at the city health department level?
Again, if they're not looking for it, they won't find it. I mean, some mold is not something that's required. Physicians are not required to report that to the health department. So these things can be occurring. And unless the health department is specifically looking at mold cases and surveilling or talking to doctors and primary care fit people about that, they're not going to know about that, and they're not going to be able to get that data. And I think that's part of the problem.
Well, listeners, let's crowdsource an informal mold map here. If you live in an area affected by Sandy, has mold become a presence in your life? Call us up and tell us what you see, what you know, what you experience, health-wise or otherwise. Let's crowdsource an informal mold map here, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Give us a call if you're in a Sandy-affected area and you want to report on mold in your home, mold on your block, mold in your area, mold in yourself, mold in your neighbors, at least as you see it or experience it. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or online at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show if you want to post a comment. Dr. Riley, if people think they might be exposed to mold, what are the most common symptoms to watch out for?
Most of the common symptoms are generally for people who are sensitive to mold or have asthma or allergies in general. They're going to get some stuffy nose, some irritated eyes. They might get some wheezing or some skin irritation. If you're allergic to mold, you might have some difficulty in breathing or shortness of breath. It might become more of a problem if you're indoors with the contamination. The other problem is people who have weakened immune systems or have diseases like emphysema or chronic bronchitis or COPD. Those individuals are probably the most susceptible to mold, and they can actually develop infections in their lungs that need to be treated in a hospital.
So anyone with a pre-existing respiratory condition should be kept clear of mold. But also, I think babies are especially susceptible, aren't they, with their developing lungs, even if they haven't been sick before?
Yes, the very old, the very young, and people with your chronic medical problems are the three groups that are most susceptible.
I have a suspicion, too, based on what I've seen, that mold can affect people's digestive systems if you ingest it, because it's around your kitchen and you can't tell it's getting in your food or as the spores go down your different pipes. But I don't know if there's science to back that up. Are you familiar with any?
It's not something that is put out by the CDC or anything like that, and I've not read any papers that have talked about that. It doesn't mean that it's not true. It just means that it's not out there in the science enough that it would be something that's talked about.
What's the latest science you know on whether different types of mold are more or less hazardous to human beings? So if people in sandy-drenched areas see the green mold or the brown mold or the black mold, does it matter?
There are some subtle, there are some subtle differences between the different types of common indoor molds. But I definitely don't know the difference. Ultimately, the treatment is the same and the remediation is the same, regardless of the type. But I'm sure there are some differences in the severity depending upon the type. You mentioned black mold or toxic mold is one type that people commonly can visualize because of its black nature. But regardless, you would treat it the same if you had lung infection, and you would do the, you'd remediate it or clean it the same way as well.
You just used the phrase toxic mold. We think of toxic in, relation to toxic chemicals, and that might be different from just an air irritant. So what's toxic mold?
Okay, so toxic mold is when you have something called a myotoxin, which is a chemical that is actually produced by the mold, which by itself makes the substance more toxic. So this is it's a fungal toxin or a chemical that's produced by the mold that makes it more hazardous to health. And this can sometimes occur with certain species or certain types of mold.
Let's take a phone call. Beth in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Beth.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My family and I are renters down in the Seaport area, and we are actually not back home yet. We've been told that we're possibly going to get back in April, maybe May, maybe June.
Wow.
I'm curious, the landlord has informed us that they've done extensive mold mitigation. They've gotten rid of all of it. What do I do as a mother moving back down there? Do I wait for my kids to start hacking away? I'm not going to be able to get entrance into the lower levels of the building to sort of scope things out with my flashlight. But this is an area that was, basically underwater.
So,
and I will take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you very much. So, Dr. Riley, she should get her home tested before she moves back in, right?
Well, the thing is that there's testing. It's tricky, and I think we've hit on the tricky point, is that there are no universal standards, and it depends on what kind of testing you do. I mean, if you're testing, surface areas with a swab, if you're taking a sample of sheetrock or something that had been exposed to flooding, there are no universal standards that say 10 parts per million of mold is the threshold that's going to make you sick. There's nothing like that that's consistent or even agreed upon. It varies from lab to lab. So generally speaking, it's actually not something that's recommended to test for mold. We saw to talk about the visual identification and the kind of using your nose and looking around to see. But one of the things that you would detect is dampness or humidity. I mean, coming back into an environment that's damp, or one of the things you want to try to tease out as a renter from the land, you know, from your landlord is if there was flooding present and they did do some remediation, making sure that they did remove all of the materials that were wet, particularly wallboard and insulation, carpet, or other heavy porous materials. If those materials were left in the walls and they just put a new, you know, panel of sheetrock above that, that would not be sufficient to protect you from the mold that would be present in the walls and things that could be growing behind there. And that could cause some health effects. So you want to definitely make sure that your landlord went in and pulled everything out, got rid of it, washed it down with detergent and water, and then put new materials, dry materials back in. So making sure that the remediation was done properly is really the key to making sure that you're coming back into a more healthy environment.
But let me see if I understand you correctly. Are you saying it's possible for the mold not to be visible to you because it's behind the walls and you can't see it, so it still might be there if the remediation wasn't done that well? But on the other hand, you're saying you can't really test for mold spores in the air with some kind of air test?
There are always mold spores in the air. There's mold spores in the air that we're breathing right now.
Right, but you can compare a normal level to an abnormal level, can't you?
You can, but you can't. There are no universal standards to do that. So the litmus test varies depending upon what sampling method you use. There's no standard for mold. And that's one of the biggest problems. You know, it's one of the reasons why the health departments don't necessarily do a lot of universal testing, because there's not one benchmark that they can point to that says this is safe, this is not safe.
Dahlia in the Rockaways, you're on WNYC. Hello, Dahlia.
Hi. I'm a community organizer who's been working with families across the Rockaways who are affected with mold. I work for Queens Congregations United for Action.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the biggest problems we find that people are facing is that they don't know if they have the mold. They've maybe tried to remediate it themselves, or they've paid contractors to come in, and now they believe the mold is coming back. So, you know, it's a real challenge that there's no official response to help people assess what the mold situation is in their home and to remediate it for those who, you know, don't have the money to pay for professional mold remediation.
So you've been approaching FEMA, Dahlia?
We've been approaching the city.
The
mayor's office in particular. We've been trying to reach regarding mold remediation.
Right. That's really interesting, especially in light of what I didn't know about the FEMA rules until I read it in the Times this weekend. And Dr. Riley, I don't know if this, as a matter of policy, is in your jurisdiction as a matter, you know, as opposed to a public health issue. But the Times did report on what seems to be an injustice in the FEMA rules. They will pay for mold damage repairs if they see the mold when they inspect your home. But the mold often creeps out of the walls and shows itself after those first few days or weeks when the inspectors were out in force. And I think it's for people who got caught in, you know, that timeline that Dahlia, the caller, is out trying to get, you know, coverage after the fact from the city. Do you know if people have recourse to go back to FEMA, perhaps, after they have proof of mold? Dr. Riley?
Oh, yeah, I don't know specifically what the rules are, but I'm sure that they could, and I would recommend that they do that, especially if they need assistance, you know, financial assistance getting that out there, because at that point, if the mold's back, it absolutely needs to be removed or it'll become a health problem.
Right, but in terms of getting coverage from FEMA or coverage from the city?
Yeah, I don't know, but I definitely would reach out and contact them again.
Right.
Definitely try to get them back, absolutely.
We think of mold as an indoor health hazard because the spores can't disperse and dissipate in the air in your home. But here is Bob Dennis, parish manager for St. Margaret Mary Roman Catholic Church in Midland Beach, Staten Island, on our show in late January.
Department of Sanitation did an absolutely fantastic job. The only thing that I would say is they dumped everything in the parking lot in Midland Beach. And that's where they actually went through it and started separating out what was recyclable and what wasn't. And then the constant moving back and forth creates a tremendous, tremendous amount of dust. And that dust just floats over the entire beach. Now, I myself have received or have a respiratory virus that's kept me home for 2 weeks from the church and put me in the hospital for a week.
Dr. Riley, does that sound like a post-Sandy health pattern that you recognize?
it's something that's definitely been anecdotally reported, because there's lots of these sites that they're just kind of storing these materials that were pulled out of these houses, and it is a problem. And anybody that's near or close to these piles, these debris piles, because it's not just mold we're talking about. It's asbestos, it's silica, it's heavy metals, it's a lot of the other things that are present in homes that, you know, are removed, lead dust, things like that. So it's a variety of contaminants, and it's not just the mold that you need to be concerned with. But if, you know, obviously, if you're anywhere near those locations, you want to stay away. If you're working with it, you want to make sure that you have the right types of personal protective equipment and respirators. But yeah, it can definitely be a health problem, especially if you're handling that stuff or you're in an area where it's going to be aerosolized or become airborne.
Anita in Brielle, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hi, Anita.
Good morning.
So you're at the Jersey Shore, right?
Yes, and I just drove up through 35 from Toms River to Brielle, mm-hmm. coming home from a meeting, and the devastation still will break your heart. But the issue of mold is one that I'm seeing in my friends, senior citizens, everyone, who seem to be developing, and this is all anecdotal, they seem to be developing respiratory problems before or just as the mold is being identified. And they've been trying to live in their homes where the crawl space has been flooded or the first floor has been flooded and they've moved up to the second floor and then have had to move out. They can't stay in the place, even though everything on that first floor has been stripped. There's a real question of whether it's been properly desanitized, if you will, or sanitized.
Right. Anita, thank you. And that brings me to my last question, Dr. Riley. There are mold testing and mold remediation scammers out there. And
absolutely.
Neither New York nor New Jersey license mold testing and mold removal companies as some states do. So what should people look for when shopping for a mold removal or testing company? Because it sounds like some of Anita's neighbors on the Jersey Shore are winding up thinking their homes have been remediated and maybe they really haven't been.
That's a great question, and you're absolutely right. They don't certify them. One of the things that you definitely want to make sure that the contractors have years of experience and they have references. So you want to be able to check those references. Ideally, if the contractor belongs to an organization like the American Industrial Hygiene Association or another professional organization, that they've taken professional training courses and they can produce certification that they've taken certain either federal or other endorsed coursework, such as from the CDC or the EPA in mold and remediation or indoor air quality. Those are the types of firms that you want to go to. This might be a situation where sort of a list like Angie's List or something like that could be helpful, where you can go in and you can look for reviews of individuals who have experience cleaning these up and that mm-hmm. can kind of use that as a screening tool to help find a contractor that's reliable.
There's also one mold testing company, and I won't mention the name, but they're on the radio and the commercial stations constantly with ads saying your mold testing company should not be the same as your mold remediation company because it's a conflict of interest. And the companies that do both are going to be more prone, this is their suggestion, they don't have time in their 30-second spots for this many words, but the implication is obvious. There's going to be a conflict of interest that would lead them to tend to say you have a bigger problem than you have, so you also pay them to do the remediation. So do you think that's a good standard to follow, that your mold testing company should be different from your mold remediation company?
I don't know that it's necessary, but, I mean, it obviously is a commonsensical sort of a point, but I don't know that it's necessary. I mean, obviously, a company that's competent in removing the material could probably also provide you with some testing. But remember, the CDC and the EPA state that you don't necessarily need to have samples taken and sent to a laboratory to confirm that you have mold. You yourself, visually or through your senses, can determine that there's mold a problem without needing to send it for a test, and that's kind of the standard. So you're probably okay just going with a reputable remediation firm as opposed to one that would you know, make you pay for extensive testing when that's not considered to be necessary.
But wait, and I'm sorry to extend this, but you said
sure.
You can tell with your senses if you have a mold problem?
Absolutely. The foul stench, certain types of odors, sort of a damp or a musty type of odor, and of course, as you mentioned in the opening, you know, different colored particles and things like
but
that.
But couldn't there be little enough mold that it's colorless, odorless, tasteless? It's in the walls, but it's enough to produce spores that are giving you respiratory symptoms.
it's possible, but that's an issue of dose. If that's the case and you can't see it and you can't smell it and you can't detect it, the levels that are present are probably, unless they're behind the walls, in which case you'd have to remove that material to check or use cameras to go behind the walls. I mean, that's a situation where you definitely need to get somebody in there that is trained and has the right equipment.
Well, I think that may well be common.
Yep.
And I'm going to throw Brian in Long Island in here because he has some tips about dealing with FEMA with respect to mold. Is that right, Brian?
Yeah, we had a client, a friend, who she had about 6 feet of water in her house in Staten Island. And it was double red tagged by the city. They were afraid to go in it. They were living in other quarters and could not get a FEMA adjuster out there. And supposedly he had visited the place and saw the double red tag and wouldn't go in to inspect. And she was caught in this conundrum between FEMA not willing to endanger the inspector, not willing to endanger himself by going in. By the time we got him to inspect the property, it was riddled with mold. And then FEMA said, you know, we don't cover mold because it's based on delay. And we had to sort of work backwards through the track to the actual claims handler for the company that was addressing it for FEMA. And I don't remember which one, but all the major companies are really doing the adjusting for FEMA. But once we got a human being and we explained the situation, what we found was they were very willing to adjust the coverage and give us mold removal and extra mold removal, actually. And the only advice I have for people is be the squeaky wheel, and you know, you don't have to raise your voice or anything else, but if you work your way back up through the system, they'll get a human being. And if your system is reasonable, there is coverage there.
It's really great advice, and I'm really glad we got you on with that, Brian. Thank you. And we thank Michael Riley, environmental health professor at the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. Dr. Riley, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Organizing for Action, the pro-Obama advocacy group, flexes its muscles. Stay with us.